He's right now a homemaker as well as a student, and he's looking for a PhD program. Responding to the paper will be John Armstrong, who has a bachelor's degree in philosophy from Brigham Young. John is the former editor and publisher of Student Review magazine. I'd like to remind everybody that tapes will be available after the session, and I'd also like to remind our speakers that Dennis has 30 minutes and John has 20 minutes to respond. If there's any time left over, we will have questions from the audience. And Dennis.
Okay, I'm just going to launch into this here. Last time I read it, it took me 32 minutes, so hopefully I'll make the deadline. The title of this paper is The Ethic of Excess Toward a Christian Economy. I'll just go ahead and start into it. An immense industrial network cannot be managed in the same way that one changes a tire. It expresses a circuit of cosmic energy on which it depends, which it cannot limit, and whose laws it cannot ignore without consequences. Woe to those who to the very end insist on regulating the movement that exceeds them with the narrow mind of the mechanic who changes a tire. This is a quote from Georges Bataille's The Accursed Chair. Georges Bataille is a fascinating thinker whose contributions to the beginnings of French anti-humanism, or what some would call postmodernism, are often overlooked. However, if I were to engage his general philosophical outlook in this paper, I would be less than sympathetic. Nevertheless, I have found his writings on economy, and in particular the ethics of economy, congenial, if not thoroughly commensurate, with my investigations into the possibilities and limits of a Christian economic ethic. Bataille's theory of economy is revolutionary, and therefore, if uncovered, may prove to be quite unacceptable to the traditional economist or political scientist. Nevertheless, I contend that Bataille's argument for his most central claim, that it is not necessity but luxury which poses the central problems for any ethic of economy, is compelling and thus must be taken into consideration. Moreover, the ethic it entails, while radically foreign to our modern individualism, is not foreign to the spirit of Mormonism. And not only does this ethic preclude contemporary capitalism, but it is neither merely a regression to a Marxist critique, and in fact shows itself to be more radical than the latter. Indeed, we might say that the presuppositions that Bataille questions are presuppositions to which capitalists and Marxists alike subscribe. Therefore, we must search for a management of the house that is beyond both the major industrial economic systems existent today. First, let us start with Bataille's argument by examining his contention that we should be worried with a general economy instead of a restricted economy. For example, when we change a tire on a car, we need to know little more than the particular functions of the parts we are dealing with. However, when we are dealing with economic relations in general, it seems that we need to know more about more than just the medium of exchange. So Bataille asks, quote, shouldn't productive activity as a whole be considered in terms of modifications it receives from its surroundings or brings about in its surroundings? Unquote. Of course, we can wax more and more general in our considerations, but indeed, we shouldn't have to understand the whole universe in order to understand our economies. So where do we stop? It seems that the answer to that question is simple. We are part of this large biomass on Earth, and so certainly its movements influence our movements to an extent. And beyond the Earth, anything other than the sun that affects us has a much more indirect relationship. Insofar as at this level, the question of economy becomes a question of energy and its circulation, it seems that we should study the economy in light of the general movement of energy through the biosphere. This is exactly what Bataille, though assuredly not a biologist, proposes to do. After establishing the need of studying the economy in a general manner, Bataille begins his most central argument. His first premise is that the biosphere has limits of growth and reproduction. This can be derived from the observable fact that species have limits of growth and reproduction, and since the biosphere is made up of its species, it too must be limited. Now, it is important to realize, though Bataille does not explicitly state this, that these limits can be in a flux depending on how much space is available. Nevertheless, these limits cannot grow infinitely due to the spatial limit we call the terrestrial sphere. They can only be in a pulsating flux. For example, before animals developed wings, there was less space than after they made this development. And then when man replaces vegetation with concrete, there is temporarily less space for growth. But this fact, that the limits can be in a flux, does not mean that the limits aren't real limits. They are limits for the biosphere as it is in a certain state, and that state will never be such as to allow for continual growth. The second premise is that there is an outward pressure that keeps the biosphere pushing out to its limits. Or in other words, the biosphere would continue growing without some sort of limit. Bataille compares the relationship of this pressure in life to its limits with that of the oversized crowd waiting to get into the bullring. Now, the nature of such a crowd is to fill up all the available seats. This nature is what is meant by pressure with regard to life. Life suffocates within limits that are too close. It aspires in manifold ways to an impossible growth. Bataille concludes from these two premises that the total volume of the biosphere does not change. Now, taken literally, this does not follow, since if the limits can be in a flux, which Bataille seems to accept, the actual volume may be in a flux relative to the non-biosphere. However, it may be that Bataille meant something different by volume, for indeed, it does follow from the above that there is a constant value that represents the relation of the biosphere and its limits, namely that the possible limits of the biosphere in its current condition are equal to the actual limits of the biosphere in its current condition. Therefore, the biosphere, like the very popular bullring, is always full, standing room only. It also seems to follow from the fact that there is an outward pressure in the biosphere that it would continue to grow if it did not have any spatial limits. Thus, since it must be energy that provides for this pressure, there is always more energy than can be used for life. This assertion seems to be an uncontroversial one in that it is true to our experience. For example, less than 3% of the sun's energy that hits the Earth is actually incorporated into the biosphere. And as we will later examine, this is one of the central premises of the economic ethic in the Doctrine and Covenants. Since if there is always more energy than can be used for life, then there is always enough energy for life. Section 104.17. Not only is there always a surplus of energy, but it seems that it is obvious that if the energy cannot be used, then it is lost. And what is meant by lost? Bataille certainly does not mean to contradict the law of conservation of energy. Instead, it seems that he means that it is lost to the realm of the unusable. It is lost without profit. The energy may still be there, but the biosphere will never be able to incorporate it. It must be expended unproductively. Therefore, there is always some energy that must be expended unproductively. If there is always something above and beyond necessity that must be spent unproductively, then there is always enough energy for the survival of the biosphere. Then the real ethical question is not how do we survive, but how are we going to expend the excess energy? The excess being our luxury, it is not necessity, but its contrary, luxury, that presents living matter and mankind with their fundamental problems. Recognizing the revolutionary nature of this outlook, Bataille states, quote, "Changing from the perspectives of restrictive economy to those of a general economy actually accomplishes a Copernican transformation, a reversal of thinking and of ethics. If a part of wealth, subject to a rough estimate, is doomed to destruction, or at least to an unproductive use without any possible profit, it is logical, even inescapable, to surrender commodities without return." But before we examine this reversed ethic, let us take on a possible objection to this conclusion. Indeed, we may grant Bataille's argument that there might be an abundance of energy and still conclude that the important part of a general economy would be the necessity. This could be argued because it would seem that any excess energy would merely bounce off the biosphere, just like as soon as the bullring is full, the remaining people must go elsewhere. Then, just as the bullring has nothing to do with the remaining spectators, neither should the biosphere. Hence, it would still be the filling up with the necessary energy that would be central to such an economy. Though this is a pressing objection, it does not necessarily follow due to the empirical fact of death, or so Bataille claims. Insofar as death opens up new space for new life forms, it also allows the biosphere to continue to incorporate new energy in place of the old energy. This, of course, is the second effect of the pressure within the biosphere that pushes it towards continual growth. By allowing death, the biosphere allows for a simulation of such continual growth. Most importantly, death shows that there is more than one way to go with regard to this need to incorporate more and more energy that the biosphere exhibits. While there is empty space, the biosphere can expand. In the absence of empty space, it can either deflect incoming energy, as the objection above has shown, thus expending that energy, or it can expend instead part of itself to allow for new space for growth. Thus, the ethical question remains, what do we expend and how do we expend it? For Bataille, an answer to the latter part of this question will entail an answer to the former part. It is more important that we should know how to expend our energy. Currently, we think that any loss is necessarily bad. But now that we have to define one type of loss as good, what makes for a good loss? It would seem that if there is inevitable loss, it would be better that we at least know what we are expending. For Bataille, loss, when it is wanted, for example in the case of religious sacrifice, is seen as glorious. This seems to be an appeal to freedom. That is, when we do that which we intend to do, we act well. This, of course, harkens back to Freud. Later, we will see this as a parallel to some elements of the Doctrine and Covenants. On the other hand, when we think we are using something productively and in reality energy is lost, then it would seem that the loss would be seen as catastrophic. For example, imagine that a person A finds a large sum of money and since her needs have been fulfilled, she spends it on a fur coat. Now suppose the money originally belonged to person B, and B dies since it was her only way to acquire food. In the case that A finds out about the cause of the death of B, it would seem that A would feel a great deal of remorse for having spent the money on something as useless as a fur coat, that is, if A is an ethical person. We might even say that this would be a tragedy or catastrophe. Hence, we have Bataille's use of the flamboyant word catastrophic in his description of what amounts to unwanted and unconscious loss. Therefore, there are two forms of expenditure to choose from: glorious, in which one knowingly expends, and catastrophic, in which one believes falsely that one is avoiding expenditure. The latter of these forms is, of course, unacceptable because the person who expends catastrophically believes a falsehood. Not only is this ethic an ethic of freedom and self-consciousness, but it seems to be a peculiarly altruistic ethic. Unproductive expenditure is to use or give something up without receiving anything in return. And though we seem to praise this sort of ethic verbally here in the Western world, we actually pay little tribute to this ethic as we demand every bit of payment for things and services that we give up. Bataille, an atheist, noticed this parallel between his analysis and altruism. And interestingly, he claims that we will give without return whether we like it or not. The real question becomes whether we do it willingly or not. Finally, one last implication of this theory before we go on to examine it in light of Mormonism. On this theoretical model proposed above, the system is disposed to incorporate more and more energy. Now, we know from biology that the lower an organism is on the food chain, the more energy efficient it is. Plants absorb energy almost directly through their use of chlorophyll. Animals then eat the plants for part of the latter's energy, and humans eat the animals and plants. Along this chain, the levels of energy diminish more and more, so the organisms must eat more and more to provide for their necessity. And thus, more and more of the food must literally go to waste because it is unusable. Therefore, by eating higher on the food chain, we use more energy. By making ourselves socially dependent on meat, which is what McDonald's would have us do, we are making ourselves dependent on more energy than is needed for our survival. Hence, since luxury is that part of the energy that is not essential to survival, the luxury of eating meat is more burdensome than eating merely plants. Luxury, therefore, makes economic life more burdensome. The same has been said about meat. The same that has been said about meat can be said about mass transportation, telephones, television, and even architectural protection. These seem to be the necessities of contemporary life. Indeed, we think there are more necessities than there really are. As we can see, the question of economy, or the management of the house, is one of the most central issues to the construction and application of any ethical system. Much of the moral content in the LDS canon revolves around this question of economy. The most plausible interpretation of the canon is that it, like Bataille's theory, radically undermines the contemporary individualist work ethic, which asserts that we deserve that for which we have diligently labored. In lieu of capitalist egoism, the scriptures propose an ethic in which we deserve nothing, but nevertheless God allows us to have our needs and directs us as to how to use any excess. A necessary element, the excess of economic relations, becomes the most crucial factor to consider insofar as this is the key to the glorification of God. In order to understand the opposition of the capitalist ethic to the economic ethic of the canon, we must clearly understand the governing ethic of capitalism. John Calvin succinctly stated the basic ethical principle of capitalism. Quote, whence do the merchant's profits come except from his own diligence and industry? Unquote. This rhetorical question exhibits the doctrine that what we have is somehow what we deserve, or as stated in another way, quote, there is no free lunch, by Hugh Nibley. Such an assertion is not foreign to the minds of Latter-day Saints. Indeed, we often enough justify our accumulation of wealth on the basis of righteous living. However, this ethic, as formulated above, seems dangerously close to Corihor's contention that every man prospers according to his genius, and every man conquers according to his strength. Of course, the mere fact that it was stated by an antichrist is not always justification to dismiss a proposition. So let us examine it a bit closer. King Benjamin argues against connecting one's wealth or lack thereof to one's deserving nature or even diligent works. He vehemently counsels against assuming that a beggar has brought upon himself his misery, and he bases his objection to such a judgment on the fact that we are all literally beggars to God, who provides us all with food and raiment. So if it is wrong to assume that someone is unrighteous because that person is lacking in substance, as seems to be the case in verse 17, then it would seem to follow that it is also wrong to assume that a rich person is rich because of her righteousness. There is no necessary connection between material and spiritual wealth. Moreover, if we are all beggars to God, and if our material wealth is a product of God's grace, as seems to be the case in verse 19, then our state of material wealth is not a product of our diligence. Hugh Nibley expresses the point well when he says, the Israelites are not to get the idea that because the Lord has turned out other people to give them the land or material wealth, it is because of their righteousness. The idea that we deserve what we have is further undermined by section 104 of the Doctrine and Covenants. Here we see that everything is a gift of God, verse 15. However, this is not a gift in the sense that it is our possession, but our stewardship. Therefore, there is no real sense in which we have anything. That's verses 11 and 12. Against Nibley's proposition in Approaching Zion, the scripture here unravels the very concept of property. And if we own nothing, then either the idea that we have what we deserve is untenable, or we deserve nothing at all. The unraveling of the notion of property is already at work in Bataille as well. Indeed, property is a sort of luxury in that it is not necessary to one's survival. Of course, for Bataille, there is nothing intrinsically wrong about property unless it leads to catastrophic expenditure. But there is nothing intrinsically wrong about property in the LDS canon either. The point seems to be, instead, that we have nothing of our own accord. If we do have property, we don't deserve it, and we certainly have no intrinsic right to it. And we should never allow property to come before the lives of others. The deaths of the latter would be an example of catastrophic expenditure. God is not about to send us to earth to die immediately. Therefore, he has given us an earth which is full with enough energy to spare, as we see in verse 17. In a very real sense, then, he has provided for the survival of mankind. For if there is always an element of excess energy, then there should be no reason for death by starvation. On the other hand, since God wants to see how we will use our life sources, he has given us the possibility to expend other human beings by incorporating the very energy that would ensure their survival. Hence, there must be an ethic by which God would have us live, which would replace the capitalist work ethic and inform us as to how we should deal with energy which is in excess to our own personal survival. The parable of the nobleman and watchtower in the Doctrine of Covenants, section 101, is the parable which gives us the ethic we need. In this story, the servants have the choice of obeying their Lord by building the watchtower or of not obeying him by allowing the exchangers to use the extra money. In that they see the tower as unnecessary, they choose not to spend their resources on its construction. But this choice actually leads to a greater expenditure of their works by their enemies in verses 44 through 54. So ultimately, no matter what their choice, the servants would find themselves expending something without return, whether it be their excess energy to build the tower or their crop of olive trees. Between the two is that in the first case, the servants would be knowingly expending, while in the latter case, they would falsely believe that they could avoid any form of expenditure. As we saw in Bataille, when we knowingly expend energy on a task that God gives us, we are expending it in a sovereign manner, because to knowingly act is to freely act. But when we think we are doing one thing and it actually results in another, That is, we don't build the tower thinking we are saving energy, but we find that it nevertheless results in expenditure, then we accomplish the latter in an unconscious manner. And to come across unanticipated expense is often catastrophic, in that the outcome is undesired. So insofar as we are to be kings and queens, it is only fitting that we should learn to expend in a sovereign manner. Moreover, the erection of sacred temples in the name of God and upon his command, which is what the watchtower parable seems to represent, is a glorification of God in that we sacrifice our own possible luxury to exhibit our dedication to God. Therefore, according to this parable, righteous expenditure is only found in sovereign and glorious expenditure, as opposed to unconscious and catastrophic expenditure. So how does this relate back to the question that King Benjamin raises with regard to giving unto the poor? As saints, God will usually provide for our needs, section 104:15. But in doing so, he may also give us much more than what we need for survival. Now, on the above account, we must necessarily expend this excess or abundance in some way or other. We may use this excess to buy luxury items, such as jewelry. The value of such a purchase is often determined by how much money one has been able to sacrifice for the purchase. Indeed, our first question when a friend has purchased a diamond is, how much did it cost? We may be purchasing the diamond for an investment or for social status, but insofar as the purchase expends a large sum of money, and insofar as this money comes from the large reserve of energy that God has given us, then if there is one person who is starving to death, we have not only expended our money, but that person as well. We have sacrificed that person. This is because our excess is the beggar's need, and thus, if we decide to expend our excess, then the beggar cannot fulfill her needs and thus dies. This expenditure, then, is both unconscious, we do not necessarily know that we kill the beggar by purchasing the diamond, and catastrophic, we find the death of the beggar to be at least unfortunate. Therefore, luxury expenditure is not fit for kings and queens, as long as there are still those who are starving, begging at the feet of those who would be sovereign. Thus, it is not surprising to see the blatant admonition in the Scriptures, "Therefore, if any man shall take of the abundance which I have made, and impart not his portion unto the poor and needy, he shall with the wicked lift up his eyes in hell, being in torment." Could this be what is meant by the statement that the rich are made low? For if someone gives of the abundance or excess that he has, would not that person cease to be rich? Not only does the ethic of sovereign and glorious expenditure, as seen in the parable of the nobleman and his watchtower, seem to shed light on other scriptures in the canon, but it quickly solves the problem of defining a just want. Nibley begs the question when he asserts, without sufficient justification, that a want is justified only when it is a true need. Indeed, if there is always an excess, as we see in section 104, then it follows that someone will always have access to more than her mere needs. On our above account, contrary to Nibley, there is no problem with this as long as every person's needs are fulfilled. For if we fulfill a want, such as purchasing a diamond, and there are others who are starving, then we expend those others. In this case, the want is unjustified. But if all have their needs fulfilled, and one would like to expend his excess on a diamond, then it seems that there is no reason to think that this act would be unjust. However, if this is our thought, then we have forgotten what constitutes a proper expenditure, a sovereign and glorious expenditure. Although it is certainly the case that where all have their needs fulfilled and one person participates in luxury, such expenditure can be considered sovereign, the question remains as to whether or not such expenditure is glorious. It would seem that such expenditure is not glorious unless it was done upon the command of God. As we have seen in section 101, God commands us to build sacred temples unto his name. These temples involve large expenditures of wealth, and they are sovereign expenditures because Christ, our King, commands them, just like the Lord of the vineyard commanded the building of the tower. They are glorious expenditures because we sacrifice our luxury for their erection, and we make ourselves holy by showing our dedication in giving glory unto God. Therefore, we should rather construct such cathedrals than buy our diamonds, yachts, mansions, and BMWs. The excess is the key to glorifying God. We can agree with Richard Johnson when he says, quote, "The central moral problem of our time is primarily economic," unquote. As long as there are those who are starving, then our management of the house, our I'm referring to the saints, management of the house is not in order. The theme of equality that runs rampant throughout the canon, for example, D&C 82:17 or Book of Mormon 4th Nephi 1:3, is only realizable if we cease to expend others and begin to use our excess for God's glory. Despite what the capitalist might say, people are not resources to be used or literally expended. Along with our injunction to become kings and queens, we have the obligation to other persons. They are not solely responsible for their own fate. We are responsible for their deaths when we do not give of our excess. To be a peculiar people is to shake off the shackles of our capitalist world and refuse to allow that the there is no free lunch ethic to permeate our lives. True Christianity would necessarily result in an economic revolution. We have seen the similarities between these two accounts of an economic ethic. Both the LDS canon and Bataille assert that there will always be enough energy for the biosphere and that there will always thus be an excess that needs to be expended. Hence, both systems seem to assert that the real question of economy centers around luxury instead of necessity. Moreover, both seem to agree that the expenditure must be conducted in a self-conscious and thus glorious manner, though there may be differences as to how particular cases are to be carried out. Finally, both seem to claim that we should look to a larger, more general picture and submit ourselves to a plan greater than ourselves rather than the anarchistic and egoistic forces that govern the catastrophic expenditure of contemporary capitalism. At this point, it might appear from the way in which I presented this economic ethic that it is thoroughly commensurate with a Marxist critique and solution. However, I think this would be misleading. Though Bataille himself did seem to have Marxist tendencies throughout his life and often associated with the French Communist Party, I contend that his economic ethic is incommensurate with that which is constructed by Marx, and for much the same reasons that it is incommensurate with a capitalist ethic. Of course, this is not to say that there are not important similarities between the two insofar as they are both radical. Nevertheless, insofar as a Christian ethic is similar to Bataille's ethic of excess, the Christian ethic is not a Marxist one. To begin with, Marx's theory of use and exchange value emphasizes necessity in lieu of luxury and excess. According to Marx, quote, this is a quote from an economist named Kuhn, exchange value is determined by the content of labor time socially necessary to produce the means of subsistence required for the maintenance of the worker and his family. Therefore, value in economic relations is determined by that which is necessary for survival. At this point, Marx and Bataille already part company. Though Marx might be right at a superficial level, Bataille would claim that there is a larger and more general movement that is influencing his valuing, and this movement has nothing to do with necessity, but excess or luxury instead. Moreover, Marx's theory of surplus value entails a concept of exploitation that is foreign to the concept of exploitation that we have already seen implicitly in Bataille's ethic. For Marx, the capitalist sets the laborer's labor time above the time that the latter needs to receive wages for survival. So the worker spends part of the day working for free. This is exploitation for Marx. What is left over is used by the capitalist in appropriation, profit, rent, capital. Indeed, it would seem that Marx, like Bataille, has recognized the importance of excess, which he calls surplus, and shows it to be the most central element to exploitation. This is anticipating Bataille and perhaps confirming him. I have another part in here where I talk more specifically about how Marxism isn't commensurate with Bataille, but I'm going to skip that because I think it's less central, and I'm going to go directly to our conclusion. So, you might ask, what is the solution of the economic problem? We have mentioned the necessity of an economic revolution. What shall be our new order? This is a most difficult question to answer because we are so ignorant about our own natures. How can we know what will work without knowing about ourselves? Nevertheless, there are some partial and fragmented answers lurking in our thought thus far. Firstly, we must recognize that to eliminate possibilities in and of itself is the first step to a solution. We now know that the two most influential forms of economic behavior in the world today have been shown to be incommensurate with the ethic necessitated by both Bataille and the LDS canon. And we know why these systems are flawed. They both use increasing production in order to incorporate the excess energy productively and thus lead to an unconscious and catastrophic expenditure. Thus, our system should not be one of increasing production. Moreover, it would seem that our new economic system should be one in which we do not spend our time figuring out how we should survive. That is the economy of necessity. Instead, the fulfillment of necessity should be seen as the very conditions of all economic activity, and not such activity itself. Thus, every person is guaranteed her needs, and the rest of our time should be used in seeing to the glorious expenditure of the excess. This would be a society worried with the perpetual elimination of luxury. These are only the most general considerations, and they are compatible with a large number of social structures. The Amish may seem to fulfill our requirements, and so would the American Indians. But on the other hand, we might even find that the Swedish have approximated our conditions, though I doubt it. The specifications of a future system seem, at this point at least, very difficult to make out, but it may be for the better that we do not attempt to specify a strict order which would be the only one ethically admissible. It might just be the case that we need to acknowledge the problems we currently have, and by refusing to live by the system that forces us to exploit, we might just find a better economic order falling into place. Therefore, instead of boring you with my economic utopia, I will end here by once more citing Bataille, and then the Book of Mormon. Here designed for an increase of their energy resources. They generally make this increase beyond mere subsistence, their goal, and their reason for being. But with this subordination to increase, the being in question loses its autonomy. It subordinates itself to what will be in the future owing to the increase of its resources. In reality, the increase should be situated in relation to the moment in which it will resolve into a pure expenditure. But this is precisely the difficult transition. And from 4th Nephi, and they had all things in common among them, therefore they were not rich and poor, bond and free, but they were all made free and partakers of the heavenly gift. Thank you.
Before I launch into my critique of Bataille's thoughts on political economy and the biosphere, and of Dennis Potter's application of these thoughts to the community of Christian believers, I would first like to make some general comments on the importance of this topic and the need to have more discussions like this one on the role of economic matters in the lives of those who are baptized into Christ's church. It is no secret to those familiar with the political temperament of the church today that Mormons in the United States tend to extol the virtues of hard work and financial independence in such a way that wealth accumulation is often justified, and the financial difficulties of the poor are seen as the result of their own laziness. This general attitude within the Church in the United States is evidenced by the shift from the largely democratic sentiment within the Church during the presidency of Franklin Roosevelt to the largely Republican one at the present time. With this shift to political and economic conservatism came a general suspicion of anything that hinted of wealth redistribution, especially if such redistribution was enforced through legislation, but also if it was voluntary. And after the collapse of communism in the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, politically conservative Mormons seem all the more justified in clinging to capitalism as the only economic alternative that has shown itself to work. And they do this even though there is a clear scriptural imperative to redistribute wealth in accordance with the law of consecration. Mormons aren't the only ones who have embraced capitalism, however. Some who have called themselves liberals in America in years past are also readjusting their sights away from socialism to some form of reformed capitalism. Take contemporary American philosopher Richard Rorty's recent capitulation, for instance. In revising his previous attachment to socialist economic goals, Rorty writes, "All I will concede is that you need capitalism to ensure a reliable supply of goods and services and to ensure that there will be enough taxable surplus left over to finance social welfare. The only hope for getting the money necessary to eliminate intolerable inequities is to facilitate the activities of people like Henry Ford and Steve Jobs, or even Donald Trump and Armin Hammer. Public virtues, as far as we can presently see, will continue to be parasitic upon private vices." End of quote. This concession to capitalism by many Western leftist intellectuals is paralleled by an open embrace of such capitalism in much of the American public. Ross Perot's recent attempt at political ascendancy is witness to this embrace. after some early enthusiasm of my own for Perrault's candidacy, it occurred to me that what turned me on to him, his common sense cliches, were available for millions of other people in the United States for 10 cents a dozen. It also occurred to me that Perrault's billions gave him the mystifying lure of omnipotence to many Americans. Louis Lapham, editor of Harper's Magazine, put it best in his critique of Perrault and the press's apparent blindness to the real cause of his appeal. Lapham writes, "What the press neglected to mention was the spiritual meaning that Americans impart to the texts of money. Enthralled by the Dionysian beauty of cash, we blur the distinction between money as a commodity and money as visible proof of both grace and omnipotence. The blurring of the distinction persuades us to assign to money the powers that properly belong to the human spirit." End of quote. I, with Lapham and with Dennis, agree that there needs to be a wholesale rejection of the connection often assumed to exist between wealth and righteousness. This rejection has, to some extent, already begun to take place in American culture with the questioning of the economic policy in the Reagan-Bush era. It is my hope that the majority of church members will also make this rejection. Dennis Potter's paper is a welcome voice in a church that is too often enamored with the false god of money. I now turn to the second part of my response to Dennis. As I make these criticisms of Bataille's theory, let it be understood that I am very much in favor of the change in consciousness that he advocates, both in terms of understanding the far-reaching implications of every economic activity that we engage in, and in terms of a shift to thinking about an economic ethic founded upon the of excess. Would that everyone had as lucid an understanding of their economic activities as Bataille had. I will call my first criticism the problem of energy utilization. In explaining his view on the expenditure of excess energy, Bataille writes, "If the system can no longer grow, or if the excess cannot be completely absorbed in its growth, it must necessarily be lost without profit. It must be spent, willingly or not, gloriously or catastrophically." Dennis interprets Bataille's statement, I think, correctly to mean there, but the biosphere will never be able to incorporate it. It must be expended unproductively. The problem for this view of energy expenditure is determining the agent doing the spending. Is it the sun, the biosphere, the human race? Bataille talks in the above statement as if the system, i.e. the biosphere, is doing the spending. But how can the biosphere spend energy which it never absorbed? If Bataille is referring to the 97% of the sun's energy which never gets translated into energy utilizable by the biosphere, then it does not make sense, to my mind at least, to talk as if the biosphere is spending energy which was never at its disposal. The question of glorious or catastrophic expenditure in this case is therefore moot. Dennis anticipates this objection to Bataille's theory with an explanation of how death within the biosphere opens up new space for energy to be incorporated. This reply begs the question of energy utilization, for death and the drive within the biosphere to incorporate new energy where the old is lost do not answer the question of how energy which is never absorbed by the biosphere, and therefore not available to be utilized within it, can be said to be expended by the biosphere. The importance of pointing out this flaw in Bataille's reasoning becomes apparent when we see its impact on the human sphere. I therefore call my second criticism the problem of human excess. One of Bataille's purposes in writing The Accursed Share is to provide a philosophical slash economic foundation for the new ethic of wealth distribution. In order to argue that humans should be concerned to give their excess to those in need, Bataille tries to establish that, as a matter of reality, there is always necessarily an excess of energy in the human sphere. This is supposed to follow from the fact that there is always excess within the biosphere at large. As I have shown above, it is not at all clear that Bataille has argued convincingly that there is, in fact, necessary excess in the biosphere. So it does not follow that there necessarily is excess in the human sphere. I think Bataille is on much safer ground to talk as if a human being, quote, ordinarily receives more energy than is necessary for maintaining life, as he does in only one place in his essay, than he is to talk as if energy, excess energy is necessarily the case, as he does in the rest of his essay. I am highly suspicious of Bataille's dependence upon this notion of necessary excess within the biosphere and the human sphere, for the same reason I am suspicious of Hegel's notion of the necessary movement of history, or Marx's idea that socialist utopia necessarily follows capitalism. They expect others to take seriously their claim that they are the oracles of an underlying reality which only they and their disciples can see. What we need to be talking about is the energy that is utilizable by human beings and how the fruits of such utilization should be consumed by human beings, since the ability to make moral decisions concerning the redistribution of goods and services seems to be a unique feature of the human race, although I would not rule out the possibility of some animals having the same ability. It does not make sense to me to talk as if the biosphere has this moral decision-making ability. And as far as excess is concerned, let it be sufficient to say that it is usually the case that humans have more energy at their disposal than is necessary to sustain life, and that humans are capable of liberality toward their fellow humans when disposing of such energy. Let me again say that these criticisms should not indicate that I disagree with Bataille's advocacy of a change of economic consciousness, especially for those who are in possession of the material excess with which Bataille is preoccupied. Indeed, the ethical imperative does seem to be upon the haves and not upon the have-nots, hence Bataille's insistence on thinking in terms of excess and not in terms of necessity. I am sympathetic with Bataille's intentions for a change of consciousness on a global scale, but realistically, I think it is only possible on a smaller scale, such as a geographically unified community like Utah Valley. Which brings me to the third and final part of my response. As far as scriptural examples of people who met Bataille's ideal, I can find five. The people of Enoch, the new converts of Alma at the waters of Mormon, the church newly reestablished by Alma and Amulek among the Nephites, the church in Jerusalem after Jesus' ascension, and the church in America during and after Jesus' visit. I bring up these examples in order that we may look to them as precedents for the enterprise that we too should be engaged in as believers in Christ. The similarities between these examples, especially the last four, are interesting. The communities referred to all consist either of new converts or members who are undergoing intense persecution. They seem to live in physical proximity to one another, and they seem to take it as a requirement of being a Christian to sell their property and give it to the poor. It is not clear from the context of these instances why they felt they had to consecrate their property to the church, except in the case of Alma's new converts at the waters of Mormon, where they were, quote, commanded of God, unquote, to do so. Not a very enlightening detail to my mind. The Doctrine and Covenants is more helpful in explaining why consecration is required of believers. As section 49 explains, it is not given that one man should possess that which is above another. Wherefore, the world lieth in sin. So where does this leave the church today? While a substantial portion of the church is made up of new converts, most members of the church are not new, and most are not undergoing intense persecution from their host societies. Most church members, except for some living in the American West, do not live in geographically distinct communities. And I have never heard of a contemporary convert that sold all of his or her possessions upon joining the church and gave them to the poor. It would seem that the church today is a far cry from reaching any degree of material equality within its ranks. But there are a few in the church, Dennis and myself included, who have not given up on the goal of equality within the church and who do not look upon the attempts to establish the united order among earlier Latter-day Saints as once upon a time stories for Sunday school lessons. And I, like Dennis, have my own ideas about how to revive interest in material consecration. The first step should be the reintroduction of a goal to establish Zion upon the earth as one of the church's principal missions. I would propose in rival with the standard three principal missions that are commonly referred to today. This, I think, would lead to a change from the, quote, otherworldly mindset, which currently dominates Mormon consciousness, one that focuses on rewards and punishments in the afterlife, and to the adaptation of the challenge to build a Zion community here and now. If this change in the Mormon consciousness were to take place, then we would no longer hear the excuse that the reason we no longer consecrate all our property to the church is that we are currently living the law of consecration on a higher level. An excuse I've heard both in BYU religion classes and as a Sunday school teacher and in priesthood meetings within the last year. I do not know what level that may be, but unless such a change in consciousness does take place, and I think that a new prophetic mandate must demand it if it is to happen, we will not fully realize the calling, responsibilities, and blessings of being true disciples of Christ.
Thank you guys very much. I'd like to go ahead and let these people answer questions from the audience. We've got about 10 minutes. Go ahead. And Quint, could you repeat the question into the microphone for the tape? Thanks.
The question is basically, there's been an underlying assumption in past economic theories that has assumed that economic systems should necessarily grow. Why do we have to necessarily have that assumption, and what would be the alternative?
Can we reach a stasis where we provide what I need, and that's it?
I'm not so sure. I can't respond to how we're going to solve the problems that you've brought up. That's not something I was attempting, or that I could even attempt to address. One, I'm not an economist. I'm a philosopher. I'm not even a philosopher yet, but I'm on my way trying to get there. But and so I'm only worried about what should be the underlying ethic of our economy, whether it's efficient and whether it works or whatever. I haven't even been able to try to deal with yet. I'm just worried what should be the underlying ethic. And I think that one of the implications of what Bataille is saying and what I understand the scriptures to be saying is that we don't necessarily have to assume that economies have to grow. Only if that serves the real economic ends, which is to, on the one hand, avoid the expenditure of others, or avoid putting our own excess, that which is in excess to our survival, putting that into our reserve, and in essence keeping it from those who would have used it for their very survival. Avoiding that type of thing, and at the same time glorifying God. I think that's a very central part of the economic ethic in the scripture, where we are supposed to glorify God. Did you want
to? I haven't exactly studied this in depth, but it does seem to me that that kind of statement made by President Tanner is, like you said, just a general, you know, wise counsel for living in American society, and not necessarily peculiarly Christian counsel as far as establishing a Christian community. As far as the church's recent policy statements on the law of consecration, I don't think there are any, really. It sort of was passed over. Wait a minute, I think he's had his hand up for a while. So.
The question is basically,
how do we do have anything to do about it?
Okay, we're young and we're philosophers, and so being almost philosophers. Well, he's got a bachelor's degree, so he's. So we don't necessarily know what it is to have luxury. And not only that, but it seems somewhat hypocritical for us to be criticizing society criticizing society. In its luxury, insofar as philosophy itself is a vocation of luxury, basically, seems to be the criticism. I've thought about this a lot. In fact, a friend of mine who's also a philosopher, who also has some of the same views that I do on this, has become nihilistic because he feels like there's no way that he can reconcile the way he lives and the way he wants to act with the way he believes he should. So there's a difficulty here, and I don't think it's just a nasty point to make. I think it's a profound point. But I need to reemphasize, though, that Bataille and the ethic of economy that I've been convinced of through Bataille is not saying that there isn't to be any excess. Or that we're supposed to somehow eliminate all the excess and then we'll eliminate all our problems. The point is what are we going to do with the excess? We have to pick and choose. We have to decide how we're going to use the excess, or not use it. The whole point is how we're going to expend the excess, because we're not going to be able to completely incorporate it. And I must agree that it would seem, at least prima facie, that to be a philosopher is not to necessarily use that excess correctly. But I've made the personal decision going into academia. It's not like I'm going into it for money, because philosophers don't make very much money. But because I feel like if we think in the Western world and in the world in general, if in the Christian world, if we begin to think about what we're doing, think carefully and rigorously, I think that we might be able to solve some of the problems that we've encountered because of the lack of thinking, because of just going gung-ho into everything and just assuming that we already know everything. And so that's probably would be my justification for doing that.